Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hi, and welcome to Pete and Gary. I'm Pete, and who are you, Gary?
I'm Gary, and this, Pete, is a special. This is a chatternatter.
Oh, that's lovely. Who are we chatternattering with?
Well, today, Pete, we're very, very lucky. We're joined by Matt McLaughlin from Australia.
Ooh, that's a long way away.
It is.
Hello, gents. Is it my turn to talk now?
No. You've obviously, you've never listened to a chatternatter. The guests don't get a word in.
No, we just rab it on and on. And this today, Gary, what we're going to rab it on and on about is the Cowra breakout, because Matt's written a book about it. You looking forward to that, Gary?
I am, because as you know, I am well-versed in the Cowra breakout and all things about it.
Yeah, liar. Anyway, Matt, your turn.
My turn? Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's going to be a good chat. I'm looking forward to it. New book out called The Cowra Breakout. Which I think our Aussie listeners may have heard of, but it'll probably be a bit of a new story to people there in the UK and our American listeners in particular. But it's a good story. It's a good World War II story, so a little bit outside the area I normally do, about a breakout of Japanese prisoners from a prisoner of war camp in Australia in 1944. So, yeah, it's good the book's out and it's a good story to tell.
Could now, you just give us a little bit of background, Matt? So where is Cowra in the country?
Okay,
it's
so
not
Cowra,
in our country.
Yeah, it's in a whole different country. Yeah, you can't get here by bus.
I thought it was by Clacton.
Cowra is a little town in the middle of regional New South Wales. So that's the state that Sydney is in. So it's about 400 kilometres.
Oh, I heard of
Sydney. Well, you're well on your way then. It's 400 kilometres west of Sydney. So once you get to Sydney, Gary, keep going. And it's way out in the middle of nowhere, but that was kind of the point, because during the Second World War, when we were capturing prisoners, I mean, it's the first really fascinating thing about the whole story is that we were capturing Italians. When I say we, I mean the Australians were capturing Italians in North Africa and then Japanese in the Pacific, and we're actually sending them all the way back to Australia. Until I really started looking into this story, I was, I didn't realize how many prisoners were actually shipped all the way back to Australia. And not just prisoners the Australians had been capturing, but when the Americans were capturing Japanese in Guadalcanal and other Pacific islands, they were also sending them back to Australia as well. So Australia became a bit of a collecting hub for prisoners of war from all over the world. And so by the mid-40s, by 42, 43, there were thousands and thousands of Italians and Japanese in this isolated little outpost. And we actually had, Cowra was actually one of seven prisoner of war camps we had scattered across Australia throughout the war.
Now, there's a cracking diagram in the book, which makes it very clear. I'm sure you drew that with your crayons and the rest of it. But just describe a bit the layout of the camp, because it's quite important to the story, isn't it? How the camp's laid out and what happens there.
Yeah, it was a really interesting one, Pete, because that was the fundamental to the whole story of breaking out of a camp was what was the camp like they were breaking out of, obviously. And it was a funny one when I looked it up, is that because the camp was originally intended for Italian prisoners of war and they'd heard all the stories about the Italians surrendering en masse in North Africa, the real feeling I had when I read the original documents about it was that it was the camp itself was more to do with a demonstration that you are a prisoner now on the other side of the world. And Cowra was selected for that reason as well, that it was a very long way away from anywhere. So I think the philosophy was that the remoteness of the location would play a big part in the feeling of captivity that the prisoners had. So when it came to actually constructing a camp, it's nothing like we would imagine from Hollywood movies of, you know, when we see the Stalag camps in, you know, with the Germans marching around with multiple lines of, you know, very, very high, 20-foot high fences with coils of barbed wire on them. It was nothing like that. The fences were only about 5 feet high. There were three lines of fences, but only about 5 feet high, and basically just coils of barbed wire wrapped all around. So it was, as I said in the book, it was a good impediment if you were going to stop someone from just scarpering off into the countryside. But they weren't particularly well fenced in within the camp. The camp itself was divided into four compounds. So two of the compounds held Italian prisoners. One of them held a bit of a mixed bag of Japanese officers and like Korean and Taiwanese laborers who'd been captured while working for the Japanese. So that was one sort of mixed bag. But the one we're most focused on was B compound, and B compound held all the enlisted men, Japanese enlisted men and Japanese NCOs. And that compound was designed to hold about 500 men. But by the time of the breakout, there were 1,104 Japanese prisoners, surly, angry Japanese prisoners crammed into this this compound. And then imagine Australians around there with machine guns and rifles, and that was basically the recipe for disaster.
And who were the guards, as it were, the Australian guards? I believe it was a militia, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Well, there's the 22nd Garrison Battalion. So these are an interesting bunch of blokes as well. And what I got most out of the book was telling the story of all these people, because I'm always fascinated with those chapters of history where you get this strange collection of very different people from all across the globe who then come together because an incident occurred that they were all involved in. And the Garrison Battalion certainly summed that up. They called them the Olds and Bolds because a lot of them were World War One men who'd been... Yeah, you'll relate, gentlemen. A lot of them were World War One men who had been too young to fight in the First World War, but now were too old to fight in the Second World War. Or they'd been men that had been fighting on the front lines and had been wounded, too badly wounded to return to combat, or just men who, for whatever reason, weren't considered fit for combat. So they were too sick or too old or injuries. You know, some of them had farming injuries that meant they couldn't serve on the front lines. So quite a mixed bag of men. And the important thing to say is that getting garrison duty to guard a bunch of Japanese prisoners in the middle of the bush in Australia was not exactly considered a prime posting. You know, these men wanted to be on the front lines fighting, not stuck in the back blocks at Cowra.
Yeah, you say in one point that they're as much in prison as the prisoners. They're isolated. They've got bugger all to do.
Cowra today is a good town. I love going out to Cowra and seeing the sights, but... if you imagine 1944, exactly. Well, the good people of Cowra, I'm sure, are listening. It is a good town, and we'll more of that later on. But in 1944, there was a big army training camp at Cowra as well, which featured in the story. So you had this bizarre mix of 18-year-old, very raw recruits, obviously going out on the town whenever they could and chatting up the local girls and filling up the pubs. And then the old guys out from the prisoner of war camp. And so it was a very strange dynamic. And, you know, Cowra had a bit of a, you know, it had a picture house, it had a few pubs, but there wasn't a lot to do there. And it's fair to say that a lot of the men, even though they got on with the job, you know, this was their job in the war to guard these prisoners, a lot of them were pretty resentful that they were stuck out there doing this job, and that led to a lot of consequences during the breakout.
Now, my turn, definitely. That was a joke, the previous one. One of the things I most liked about the book was that you go through some example prisoners, so Japanese prisoners. So you look at their backstory, how they came to be there, and that brings you to be able to tell bits about the raid on Darwin and other such things. Did you find it difficult to research into those particular individuals, or did they sort of fall into your lap?
Well, I mean, you guys know this from writing your own books as well, but it's funny how the story takes on a bit of a life of its own, that... I wanted to paint a picture. I didn't want people to think that the Cowra breakout was the start and end of the story, because it was 2 hours effectively on one night in 1944. So I wanted to say, well, who were these people? And again, what I said before about different people coming together. So I did want to tell some of those backstories, but I didn't realize how rich the stories would be and how involved I'd get in telling those stories. So that was supposed to be just a small couple of introductory paragraphs. but in the end became entire chapters in the book because I just really wanted to tell their story. And then weaving that through the historic narrative, I think really made it a much more emotive story, and it made it a story you could relate to a lot more. So, yeah, I told the story of Hajime Toyoshima, who was a Zero pilot who actually flew at Pearl Harbor and then was shot down over Darwin and became our first prisoner, our first Japanese prisoner of the war. So there was a story of an infantryman called Mariki. He had a fascinating story, being wounded and captured in New Guinea. The story of some other naval aviators who were shot down when their observation plane was shot down north of Australia. So a whole range of both Army and Navy men who became the prisoners, but also then, yeah, some of the stories of the Australians about what they'd been up to before they came to the camp, like Harry Doncaster and the blokes on the machine guns. So there was a whole range of really good backstories. And as I said, I think it just gave a lot more depth to the story of the breakout itself.
One of the things that interested me, Matt, was that the Italians seemed to be quite accepting of the situation, but for the Japanese, of course, it was a shame to be in captivity and to have surrendered effectively. And do you think that contributed to the friction between them and the guards at their camp?
Yeah, absolutely. And I might actually break that down into two parts because it's worth noting the distinction. So yeah, we'll get to the Japanese in a minute and their motivations for breaking out of the camp. But you're right with the Italians. They were incredibly docile. Even the Japanese prisoners couldn't understand the Italians. And some of the quotes I enjoyed most in the book were what the Japanese had to say about the Italians and how, even though they were supposed to be on the same side, how little they shared in common, except for the fact that they're all prisoners. But the Italians, if you imagine, you know, we all know about Italy during the Second World War, they surrendered in large numbers. They weren't particularly dedicated to the cause. A lot of them were conscripts. They didn't have much interest in fighting. And so, you know, especially in North Africa, they fought a bit more spiritedly in Italy, but in North Africa, a lot of them were not particularly interested in fighting. They surrendered pretty readily. And then once they surrendered, they were pretty docile prisoners. And so the Australians realised that they had this sort of free labour force. And a lot of the Italians were farm workers and they had a bit of access to this sort of free labour force. And so they would send the Italians out to local farms, completely unsupervised. And that led to all sorts of interesting occurrences that I detailed.
I saw that bit. Sex raises its ugly head. You're clearly shocked by the details of that whole incident between Mr. Smith and the Italian.
Oh, Vito, yeah. I found this document and it was lying just in a whole different section of papers. I don't even know where it came from. But it detailed just this Italian prison and this really sordid affair with the farmer's wife and how distressing the whole thing was, and the Italian eventually saying, I want to be sent back to the camp. So the Italian preferred to be back in the prison camp than having to put up with the advances of this lady on the farm, which he did succumb to, I should mention. But so that was the thing. I mean, my favourite anecdote that I always tell about to demonstrate what the Italians were like is one day a bunch of them went out on a work party completely unsupervised in a truck, but at nighttime when it was time to come back to the camp, the truck got a flat tire. By the time they fixed it and got back to the camp was all locked up for the night and all the gates were closed, everything, and the searchlights were going around, and the Italians had to bang on the door of the camp until the Australians came in and let them back into the camp. So the Italians, that was a fun part of the story, was talking just about the Italian experience and very different to the Japanese. The main part of your question, Gary, was what the Japanese were like. And shame is probably the best word we have for it in English, but doesn't begin to delve into the depth of what they were feeling. So the best way to describe it is when a Japanese man left to go to the front during the Second World War and his family and his community wished him all the best, they weren't saying, thank you for your sacrifice to go off and fight. They were saying, thank you for your sacrifice to go off and die. So they were not expected to return. And obviously the shame of capture was something that was completely abhorrent to them. And so when a Japanese soldier went missing in this regard, everyone just assumed he was dead. So his family back in Japan was told that he'd been killed. His family would hold a funeral service for him. And they'd proudly say, you know, our son gave his life for the empire. And the Japanese in the camp knew this. They were also very frustrated by the fact that they hadn't managed to die on the battlefield. They'd seen thousands of their comrades reaching this noble, heroic death for the empire all around them, and somehow they'd missed out. Usually that was because they were too sick or wounded to resist capture. It wasn't often that a Japanese just gave themselves up. Usually they'd been shot up and they woke up in hospital and realized they'd been captured. So they call themselves ghosts. They said, we're trapped between these two lives. We can never go back to Japan. And yet here we are just sitting around in this camp. We're not doing anything to contribute to the war effort anymore. We should have died on the battlefield. And so it just bred these immense feelings of we have to do something to earn back our honor, that we've disgraced our families, we've disgraced our communities, and we have to do something to revive this honor that we've now lost. So the seeds of the Kaura breakout had been sown months before it actually occurred, and the Japanese didn't quite know what they were going to do, but they knew they had to do something. And that was a pretty common occurrence in Japanese prisoner war camps all around the Pacific. It was pretty standard that Japanese would eventually rise up and cause trouble if given a chance.
Now, one of the things, again, from your book that I liked was you managed to find this story of this Japanese chap who sort of goes to the authority and says they're planning a breakout and provides all this. I've forgotten his name, but forget everything. Get me head if it wasn't screwed on. But he gives a load of details, which is sort of is more than the camp intelligence authorities, you know, the intelligence officer of the camp, all the rest of them, worked out in months. And he goes and tells them that something's brewing. I found that very interesting. I don't remember what happened to him, because the names do blur.
They do, indeed.
That's cultural, and it's my fault, not the book's fault or anything else. Do you remember this guy? How did you find out about him?
It's a great story. I found out about this really easily, actually, because the failures of intelligence. Yeah, it was literally that. The failures of intelligence. It's just mind-boggling that this was staring them in the face, that the Japanese are going to do something. The Japanese are planning to break out of the camp, and yet we still let it happen. And the reason we know about this report from this informer is he was a Korean who didn't particularly like the Japanese. He'd been press-ganged into the Japanese army. So he wasn't any fan of the Japanese. And on his first day, he overheard Japanese prisoners talking to the new arrivals and saying, we're hoarding weapons. We're planning to break out of the camp. And we're going to attack the guards and break out of the camp. And so knowing that this could earn him a little bit of favor, he went to the authorities and told them. And they believed him, absolutely believed him, so much so that they issued reports that they distributed not just to the Kaura camp but to all the prisoner of war camps in Australia, saying we've got good information that any Japanese prisoners in your custody are not going to put up with it anymore, and they're going to rise up and break out of the camp. And it was the weird thing about it was taken so seriously that they decided they were going to remove half of the Japanese prisoners, more than half, two-thirds of the Japanese prisoners were going to be taken out of the camp and moved away to try and mitigate the risk. And ironically, that was the spark that led to the whole breakout, was the threat that they were going to move the prisoners away. So it's this weird convoluted circle where the Australians knew, in order to try and make sure it didn't happen, they actually caused it to happen. So bizarre situation. But, I mean, the Australians, and I said this in the book, should have taken a lot of blame for what occurred, that a little bit of, you know, better practice in the camp would have meant that it didn't occur at all.
I believe his name was Matsumoto.
Matsumoto, that's him. Japanese name, but he was a Korean because obviously during the war, the Japanese, you know, did everything they could to make the Asian people.
I'm looking daggers at you, you bastard.
I wrote it down yesterday.
That's a good part of the story, though, and he was an interesting character to tell the story of.
Now, so take us through what happens then. So do they actually do anything other than plan to move prisoners? Or is it still just this 5-foot-tall barbed wire? There's a couple of Vickers machine guns badly sighted. You make a big point about that. And there seems to be a Bren or two about, and rifles. Are there any increase in security at all?
Well, this is the extraordinary thing. Yes, they took some superficial precautions. As you say, they put in these couple of machine guns. They, they issued hand grenades in very limited quantities to the garrison without giving them any training on how they would work. I mean, that's obviously not going to go wrong, is it? Let's just distribute some
Gary's
mill bombs.
An expert on hand grenades.
And do your best. So they gave everyone more. I mean, the cooks received rifles all of a sudden. The cooks hadn't been armed before, but now they received a rifle and were sort of shown how to use it. So they did a few sort of precautionary things, but the when I was writing this book, I was just constantly frustrated as I read about what had gone on, because I just thought this never should have occurred. There should be no book to write about the Kaura breakout because it never should have occurred. The story of the Kaura breakout should be the Japanese prisoners were getting a bit cranky and looking for an opportunity to do something, and the Australians stamped it out efficiently. That should have been the story of the Kaura breakout. Wouldn't make for much of a book, but that's what should have happened, because not only were they going to move these prisoners out of the camp to mitigate the risk. That was a very sensible move. They absolutely should have done that, but I couldn't believe it. They gave them 2 days' warning. They said to them on a Friday, at Friday lunchtime, they said to them, on Monday, we are going to move half the prisoners out of the camp. They gave them the full weekend to know about it. It was, I just, why would they do that? Why would they tell them? Why wouldn't they just march them onto trucks and get them out if they thought there was this big risk? And so they told them on Friday, I still have no idea why, they just felt that they should inform the Japanese that we're moving you out of the camp. I told them on Friday and the Japanese just said, okay, we have to do something now. And so Friday night, the breakout occurred. So just constant frustrations. There weren't enough men. They didn't ask for any more men to protect the camp. The machine gun they had in place to guard B compound was not manned. They used to put troops on it in the daytime, and then at nighttime they'd go back to their barracks and just leave the machine gun standing on its own. They didn't have supporting riflemen for the machine guns. They F tower on the far side of the camp that looked over B compound and another compound as well had one man in it, and he had an Owen gun, which is a little submachine gun, and a few hand grenades. That was the only protection for that entire eastern side of the camp. It's just frustrating. And Friday night was payday, so the troops were all having a bit of a piss up in the canteen. It was just a terrible situation.
They were told 2 days beforehand because they had to have time to pack.
Exactly. Fold their socks and make their beds.
Yeah.
Not to mention sharpen their weapons and prepare to set fire to their huts, which is what they actually did.
What were the improvised weapons they had? Because I like that bit as well. Tell us a bit about that. The Japanese made my favourite was the sharpened spoon.
there's a couple of elements to this. There's a big debate about how premeditated the breakout was and how spontaneous it was, and it was a key feature of the later investigations because obviously it made the Australians look pretty bad if the Japanese had been planning this for a long time. So it's a balance. The Japanese were intending to do something, and the something was break out of the camp, but they hadn't quite worked out. So they'd worked out the strategy. You know, you taught me about strategy and tactics, Pete. They'd worked out the strategy, but not the tactics. And so the night of the breakout, they basically set to work with the weapons. My favorite one, Pete, the sharpened spoons. One guy took the steel plates out of his shoe and sharpened those on the concrete. So they weren't particularly, well armed, but again, that was the point. It was an attack against machine guns to show this warrior spirit that they had. The number one thing they did have a lot of was knives, which is ridiculous that they were allowed to have access to knives without them being properly, you know, counted and accounted for. And the other thing was two baseball bats. They were allowed to play baseball, and they recovered some preposterous amount, like nearly 100 baseball bats they recovered. So it seems that every time a Japanese person said, "Can I have a baseball bat?" they were just issued with one. So a preposterous number of baseball bats, but there's a photo in the book. I mean, I shouldn't laugh. It shows the desperation of these men, but the photo in the book shows a selection of the improvised weapons, most of which are sharpened butter knives and baseball bats and things like that. But there's the neck off a guitar that had been, someone had bashed nails, that they'd ripped the neck off a guitar and bashed nails into the head of the guitar. So, you know, they didn't have access to a lot of weapons. Some guys just grabbed a lump of firewood from the fire. It wasn't going to be a suicide charge, but they did want to take the battle to the Australians and kill as many Australians in uniform as they could. But it was part of the mentality, we'll take whatever we can get and we'll just go and we'll just charge, and that sort of warrior spirit. And that's exactly as it sort of turned out. The numbers of Japanese that ended up committing suicide with the sharper knives that they carried in their own hands was really quite horrific, and so it was certainly an audacious attack, but incredible bravery, just incredible bravery.
So the breakout occurs on the night of the 5th of August, isn't it, Matt?
That's right, in the early hours, about 2 a.m. So they'd been told that afternoon that the move was on, they were going to move all the prisoners to Hay, and so that afternoon and evening, the prisoners all got together and they voted on whether they would break out or not. Quite famously, on a piece of toilet paper, they wrote down whether they were for or against. So it gave this impression that it was a democratic decision, and it was in some instances, but in other instances, men were press-ganged into it and basically just went along because they felt it was the right thing.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So take us through the actual, your, you can't tell our story, buy the book, listeners. And
exactly,
viewers.
Buy the book.
But just give us an outline of what happened that terrible night, because it was a terrible night.
It was absolutely horrific, and excuse me, in the book, that's why I call it the, what I say is we shouldn't think about this as a prison breakout in the sense of trying to earn freedom. It was nothing to do with that. This was a battle, pure and simple. The Japanese wanted to fight and kill as many Australians as they could, and so that was the point of the whole thing. So the Japanese, at about 2 o'clock in the morning, Toyoshima, that Zero pilot I'd mentioned, the first Australian prisoner, he had a bugle with him, an army bugle. And he blew the bugle, and that was the signal to begin the breakout. So the Japanese charged. So nearly a thousand, not everyone participated, but close to 1,000 Japanese charged out of their huts. They set fire to their sleeping huts, and then basically charged towards the fences. So there were three distinct parts of the breakouts. So I'll give you a very quick overview. One group charged into the middle of the camp to try and let the Japanese officers out and to try and attack the guards straight up the guts of the camp. That did not go very successfully because of obviously the Australians just opened fire on the Japanese as they surged in the middle of the camp. One group ran towards the far wire on the other side of the compound, that area where I said was only guarded by one man with an Owen gun, and they broke through that part of the wire. And actually, that was where the most escapees occurred. About 300 men managed to get through the wire at that point. And they broke out into the countryside. But the main part of the attack and what the Japanese really wanted to do was they wanted to attack one of the machine guns. They saw that the machine gun was unmanned at nighttime. And they thought if we can get to that gun, we can then turn that machine gun. It was a Vickers gun just on a truck trailer just on the other side of the wire, only 50 meters on the other side of the wire. If we can get through the fence and get to that gun, we can turn it on the garrison and we can kill a lot of Australians. Then we're going to take over the camp. And then we'll see what we can do next. Maybe we'll launch an attack on the army camp next door. They didn't really know what they're going to do at that point, but the machine gun was the key. And so the most horrific aspect of the entire breakout probably was what I refer to in the chapter that was the race for the Vickers gun. Because imagine the situation. So about 300 Japanese charged towards that gun. So they had to get through three lines of fences, and then they had to get they wanted to get to this machine gun. And so the two Aussie gunners who were tasked with manning that that gun, Privates Hardy and Jones, were asleep in their barracks. They heard the prisoners breaking out. They jumped up. They threw on their greatcoats over their pajamas. They pulled on their boots, didn't even do up the laces, and ran to the machine gun in their pajamas. And it was literally a race between the 300 charging Japanese armed with knives and baseball bats and these two Aussie privates, both in their 40s, And Jones and Hardy managed to get to the gun before the Japanese, and opened fire on the Japanese and caused lots of casualties, and another machine gun opened fire as well, and a lot of Japanese were killed in the wire. But there were just too many Japanese, and eventually they got through the fence, they got to the trailer. Jones and Hardy would have been forgiven for, fleeing in the face of this, but they didn't. They stayed on the gun, and they actually eventually disabled the gun just before they were overwhelmed. And the Japanese overwhelmed them and killed them both on the trailer, bashed and stabbed them to death. But the Japanese were not able to get the gun in action against the Australians because Hardy and Jones had successfully disabled it. And so that sort of upset the main plan of the Japanese attack. But that's, that's a really terribly tragic and sad moment. Just imagine how awful those last moments would have been for those two old men. And you just think to yourself, why the hell am I even here? You would have been thinking, I'm out in the middle of nowhere. I'm way too old. They were both First World War veterans, but neither had served. So this was their second war. Neither had fought in the front lines. They'd both served in the army during the First World War, and they were in their second war, and just, both of them in their mid-40s. You'd think, what the hell am I even doing here? But very heroic. They fought to the end, and both of them were eventually awarded the George Cross posthumously for their work on the gun. So the civilian equivalent of, or the non-combat equivalent of the Victoria Cross. So that's one of the most compelling stories of the breakout.
It certainly was. It was... they're real heroes, it seems to me, especially disabling the gun.
Yeah, absolutely.
To have the presence of mind.
Yeah, it was just one of those things, I think, you people in those moments, and, they would have known as well, as the Japanese swarmed all around them. They're on the back of a truck, for God's sake. It's just terrible. Once the Japanese got through the wire and were swarming all around them, they would have known that they were gone. And the last thing they did was disable that gun, so that obviously saved a huge number of lives and also changed the entire course of the breakout, because now the Japanese didn't sort of quite know what to do now that they'd failed in the attack on the machine gun. So it was just absolutely heroic and extremely well deserved, those George Crosses.
Can we talk about numbers for a little while, Matt? So
yeah, sure
how many POWs actually managed to escape on that night?
Okay, so there's 1,104 men answered the roll that morning when they did the roll call. So that's the total number of Japanese. A fair number of the Japanese, probably 20 or so, or maybe 20 or 30, committed suicide before the breakout occurred. So either hung themselves or some of them stabbed themselves with knives. So ritual suicide. And we should point out again that our Western view of suicide is very different to the way the Japanese saw it. And even veterans that I saw were interviewed, Japanese survivors, decades after the breakout, were still very proud of the men that had chosen to commit suicide. So I think just under 1,000 actually participated in the breakout. So very close to 1,000, but not quite 1,000. All of the ones that attacked into the main area of the camp, which was known as Broadway, none of them escaped. Some of the men who attacked the machine gun, that was where the most casualties occurred, but some of the men who got through the wire at the machine gun took off into the bush, and a lot got through down the fence I described before near F Tower, the very poorly armed bloke in F Tower. So probably somewhere around 300, a bit over 300, managed to actually get out of the camp. So 230-odd, 200 and probably something like 200 and two, just over 200 were killed within the camp during the breakout attempt. And then there's more than 300 who now got out of the camp. And once they're out of the camp, they just disappeared into the night and just headed off into the bush. So that was really the next phase of the whole saga, was we've got hundreds of Japanese roaming around the countryside. And so what do we do about it?
Oh, this is the old oral history question. What happened next?
It's two questions. I'm glad you asked.
What happened next, and why did you do that? But this is slightly different. What happened next?
isn't the common question, what's the most exciting thing that happened to you during the war?
That was another interview. I was much more boring than that.
So this was the next, and again, I call this the Great Roundup in the book, because again, and just another fascinating chapter. The Aussie authorities were obviously incredibly embarrassed about this. From the earliest moments when reports first reached Sydney during the breakout that something was happening at Cowra, the immediate thought of all the authorities is, we've got 20,000 Australian prisoners being held by the Japanese, so we have to manage this situation really, really carefully, because we don't want the Japanese taking retribution against the Australians that they're holding on to. Not that the Japanese needed any excuse to obviously mishandle prisoners in their care, but they didn't want to do anything to exacerbate the problem. So that was the big deal. So the cover-up began from the moments that the Japanese first got out. And the authorities didn't even want to tell the people of Cowra that the breakout had occurred, because they didn't want word leaking out. And so obviously that was considered pretty bad. I mean, a couple, you know, three guards had been killed within the camp during the breakout. So they knew that there were armed and very fanatical, dangerous men roaming the countryside. So the first question was, we've got to tell the people of Cowra that there's armed prisoners roaming around. It took 9 days to round them all up. So this incredible chapter of the whole story was the interactions of local people with the escaped Japanese prisoners. The Japanese were very clear that they were not going to harm civilians. It was only men in uniform that they would attack, and they stuck to that very, very closely. So the local people weren't actually under threat, but they didn't realize that at the time, of course. And there's a lot of very interesting reports.
I found that very interesting that the Japanese had made that so. I mean, that was a definite policy they weren't going to hurt Australian civilians. And I found that quite interesting that they took that view.
Well, yeah, restoring honour was a very big part of this whole saga. And so I think that they felt that obviously, you know, hurting innocent women and children was not part of that. You know, we are warriors and we are, it explains the mentality very well. If you think about it from the terms of, oh, let's just get out of the camp and do whatever we can, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But if you think about warriors trying to restore shame that they'd lost on the battlefield, it makes a lot more sense. And, you know, in the very Japanese sense, it was very well organized. You know, they had a committee meetings before the breakout to discuss how it was going to happen and who was going to do what. But the leaders emphasized very strongly no civilians are to be hurt, and that absolutely happened. So no, I should say, interestingly, no prisoners hurt civilians, but that's not to say it didn't work in reverse. And there was a couple of incidents that were pretty unsavory that I came across. Yeah, the main one, which almost turned this from, you know, it was bad enough that this breakout in a camp had occurred and soldiers had been killing other soldiers. But then a bloke went out with the day after the breakout, when everyone in town was pretty excited, a bloke went out with his young son. What he told authorities was, we wanted to get some rabbits to feed the dogs. So he went out with his shotgun to get some rabbits, but obviously he hoped he could be part of the action, and he got his wish. He ran into a group of Japanese, and in his report to the police said that they tried to circle around us and they were going to attack us and we were threatened for our life. So he opened fire with a shotgun and killed two of these unfortunate prisoners. So again, I made that point in the book that it was one thing that this escape had occurred in a sort of a prison army compound environment, but the idea that civilians were now roaming around the countryside shooting unarmed Japanese took the whole thing to a new and scary diplomatic level, that how are the Japanese going to reply to this? And so that whole bit was actually very strongly covered up in the whole thing, and it was very hushed up, the idea that that a couple of Japanese had been killed by a civilian with a shotgun. But yeah, as you can see from all of these yarns, some of them quite humorous as well. You know, one guy set up a trap for Japanese outside his farm, and then his dog chased a cat into the trap, and he injured himself chasing the dog, and yeah, you know, all these sort of. A lot of them were quite humorous stories. Another one about a couple of a couple of Japanese approached him, so he locked him in the chook pen and waited for the authorities to arrive. So a number of humorous stories, but also some quite sobering ones that described army authorities being called by a farmer to say there's a bunch of Japanese just sort of loitering around. You know, they're just sort of sitting around. And then the soldiers turning up and shooting them all on sight, and a number of unsavory stories as well. So it was there's not much about this entire story that is glorious, or it's all pretty horrific stuff.
Now, you mentioned that the whole thing ended after about 10 days with the roundup of the remaining prisoners. And you also mentioned that the sort of cover-up started. Now, the Australian government did hold an inquiry, didn't they? And one of the things they found was that the prisoners were treated in alignment with the Geneva Convention. Do you think that absolved them of any responsibility?
It's a great question, and like so many things, there's so many different angles to answer it. So, yes, well done. Well done. You're working
hard. Proud of him.
Okay, a couple of angles on this. Yes, there were three inquiries held, in fact, as was required under the terms of the Geneva Convention, even though Japan was not a signatory to the Geneva Convention. They still treated the prisoners in this way in the hope that the Japanese would reciprocate. It wasn't the Geneva Convention as we know it today, by the way. That didn't come until after the war, but the terms that were starting to be spelled out that would lead to the Geneva Convention. which basically called for prisoners to be well treated, and if any of them were harmed, to hold an inquiry to find out who was responsible and to lay charges in a military court against anyone responsible. So we certainly did that in our as part of our responsibility, but from the outset it was a whitewash. And it's funny, and I was in two minds about this. The first military inquiry was a little bit of a joke. They were actually, when the government put the military inquiry in place, they actually gave them the specific terms for what they wanted them to find. And they said in no uncertain terms, we want you to hold an inquiry that blames the Japanese and finds no fault with the Australians. And so that's effectively what the military inquiry did. So they, you know, they interviewed guards. There was about 60 witnesses they called, including Japanese prisoners. And they interviewed them all, and then they drew the conclusion, surprisingly, that the Japanese were completely to blame and the Australians were not at fault. So the interesting thing was, even though that was a complete whitewash, that inquiry, and just gave the results that the government wanted, they were actually spot on. I mean, who are you going to blame for the breakout of the camp? It was the Japanese prisoners. Did the Australian guards act with restraint? In the most part, they did. You know, they fired on Japanese prisoners when their life was at risk, and they stopped firing when, you know, after the whole thing was over. So you actually can't fault the findings of the inquiry, but they got to it more by luck than good work.
Gary, have another question. Otherwise,
well, actually, Gary, just one other thing I also want to say about that. I just remembered is that one of the chapters of the book. I don't know if you, I know that you guys didn't have time. I didn't give you time to read the whole thing cover to cover. One of the facets, another inquiry was held, and this is one part of the story that should be told, and we should certainly remember, is that the army camp that I mentioned next to the prisoner of war camp, they were instructed to assist with the roundup of prisoners. But again, it was done in such a farcical and incompetent fashion. So the army guys at the training camp are all sort of 18-year-old recruits. They decided that they couldn't be trusted with carrying rifles out, sort of rounding up prisoners. And so they instructed them to go out in groups of 20. So 20 recruits led by an officer. The 20 recruits would carry only bayonets in scabbards, no weapons whatsoever, just a bayonet in a scabbard. Now, the first part of that is, why didn't they at least give them unloaded rifles? Because, you know, a bayonet, as I said in the book, a bayonet attached to a rifle is a much more formidable weapon than a bayonet held in the hand. And plus, the Japanese wouldn't have known the rifles were unloaded when they were pointed at their face. So they should have done that, but instead they didn't. They just gave them bayonets that they just carried. Their officers were instructed not to carry any weapons whatsoever. The officers, I have no idea why that was the case, but the officers were told, don't carry weapons at all. I think the commanding officer afterwards at an inquiry said that he was worried that he didn't want any more Japanese to be killed because he was worried about the fate of Australian prisoners in Japanese hands and all this stuff. It was just ridiculous. But anyway, fast forward to the story of Lieutenant Harry Doncaster, who was a veteran of North Africa and Greece, leading a bunch of 20 young recruits. Dark was falling by the time they sent them out. It was getting dark. He's completely unarmed, and they came across a bunch of Japanese that they were trying to round up. The young recruits panicked and ran down the hill, left Doncaster on his own, which is understandable. And the Japanese swarmed all over him and beat him to death. So he was the fourth Australian to be killed in the breakout. It was an unarmed officer rounding up prisoners in the dark. So another inquiry was held by the army, and this time it was a proper military inquiry to work out why that had been allowed to occur. And there were several stern words and reprimands, but no one was really held to account for the death of Harry Doncaster. But that was just another chapter that just never should have occurred.
It's a terrible story all round, isn't it? It's the wrong word for it. Did you enjoy writing it? I think because you can. We all write about terrible things, but you can. It's just interesting finding out about these things, getting to know. It's like a detective story at times, isn't it? Just finding out.
It absolutely was, Pete. And when I started, I didn't realise the depth of what I would find out because I, as I said, I grew up with this story. My grandparents, I grew up in a town called West Wyalong, which is about an hour down the road from Cowra. And my my grandparents used to tell me the stories about the Cowra breakout when I was a kid. And and they talked about how the Japanese prisoners used to come through the town. The trucks used to come through the town when they were delivering the prisoners. And I remember my grandmother saying she saw her first Japanese prisoner. She was surprised how tall he was because she expected to see all these little men like she'd seen in the propaganda. So
she wasn't called Mrs. Smith, was she?
Oh dear.
We'll let that one slide. I did enjoy it. I enjoyed finding those stories. I was horrified a lot of the time. I was frustrated a lot of the time. I think my long-suffering wife was you know, every time she'd run in the ring going, what's wrong? Because another Jesus Christ from me every time I realized another terrible thing that had occurred. So a lot of frustration, a lot of sadness in telling this story because it just never should have happened. This, you know, I said before, this never should have happened. But yes, I did enjoy revealing the story. Just really, it's a really great human story. At the end of the day, it is a human story. It's about emotions and people driven to, you know, desperation and you know and the way people responded to that. So it was a very human story. So yeah, I really enjoyed telling those stories.
Now, the breakout comes to an end. That's not the end for the camp, is it? The camp continues beyond that point.
The camp goes
on to beyond the war and repatriation.
Yeah, exactly. So the other aspect of the story that was interesting was the civilian internees, which always played a part in the story as well. It wasn't just prisoners of war that were held in these camps. It was civilian internees and camps like Cowra and the other ones continued to be used. But yeah, the camp was still open in the late 1940s because it took a long time to get people sorted out. So most of the Japanese were sent home in 1946 because it wasn't a big priority getting prisoners home from the war. But yeah, civilian internees were still held there and the camp existed in one form or another until about 1949 when it was hurriedly and under the cloak of darkness sort of torn down and buildings were, a lot of them were sold off. They were prefabricated buildings, so they were sold off and there's reports that, oh yeah, that was the wool shed on my farm, was an old Japanese, you know, used to be a Japanese sleeping hut from the camp. And but then it was torn down in the 40s and the whole thing was then swept under the rug for a very, very long time. And you know, this empty paddock, I think, is a good representation of the whole story, that it was wiped from the face of the earth. And I think the authorities hoped the whole story would be wiped from memory because it was a long time before, even in the 1960s, Harry Gordon, who wrote a really good book about the Cowra breakout in the 60s, he had to petition the government under sort of the early Freedom of Information Act to even get information about it because the government was still trying to cover up what had gone on in Cowra. So, you know, extraordinary story all around.
Now, the book's called The Cowra Breakout. Now, the publisher, Hachette, is it coming out in anywhere else in England?
It's being distributed. Yes. Yeah. I've got a copy of it here. It's being distributed. There it is.
Lovely
shiny
cover.
So it's on sale.
Has it got a picture of you on it?
It's got a tiny little picture of me down the bottom there.
When you were
very
young.
Very small.
Before your hair went grey.
You probably took that photo, Pete. It's at Gallipoli, I think. the book's out now in Australia and also being distributed in the UK. So select importers bring it in the UK. So you can find it there as well. It's a really good story. I think it's a funny thing. I think in Australia, there's a lot of people that know it and will go, oh, I'm interested to hear about this story again. And a whole heap of people that go, I've never heard of this before. You know, you always hear the line, why weren't we taught this in school? So I think there's going to be a lot of interest from people to sort of relive this quite interesting chapter of World War II history.
Yeah, I mean, I was really surprised, Matt, because as I said, I've never heard of it. And one of the things I discovered was how many times it's been depicted in films and literature. Yeah. There was a 4.5-hour miniseries, The Cowra Breakout in 1984. But my favourite was... on that day, our lives were lighter than toilet paper. The Great Cowra Breakout.
Oh, great, great, great title.
It is, and I'm a bit disappointed that you didn't pick up something similar.
Yeah, yeah. Something to do with toilet paper would have been interesting on the cover. With fishes.
I think fishy toilet paper.
Die Like the Carp, what Harry Gordon called his original book. But
it's just the worst title ever.
Isn't it terrible? It's a terrible title. But a good book, great book, terrible title. But Gary, you mentioned the miniseries, and the miniseries was actually one of the things that got me into military history because I was a 10-year-old when that miniseries came out. I watched the whole thing, and it wasn't a very accurate depiction of the Cowra breakout, but because it was my local area and I just thought it was a really engaging story as a 10-year-old, I thought it was amazing, and I watched it about 1,000 times. And it was one of the things that I would mark as giving me an interest in the military history. And then my dad took me over to the camp, which wasn't a camp anymore. It was just an empty paddock. And he took me over for a bit of a look around.
Watch out for snakes.
Watch out for snakes. That's what I mentioned in the book. I should also mention the cemetery that's at Cowra now, because the Cowra does an incredible job of remembering this chapter. And there's an incredible Japanese garden, which is very out of place in rural New South Wales. The remains of the camp, which is now, they do a very good job of pointing out where various things went on, and people can encourage to visit it. But of course, the cemetery there where all the Japanese that were killed in the breakout are buried. And in addition to that, every Japanese national who died in Australia during the Second World War is buried in that cemetery. So about 550 people. So airmen that were shot down in raids over Darwin, sailors whose ships were sunk in the great naval battles, Coral Sea and things like that. And a lot of civilian internees are also buried there alongside the prisoners. So it's that the Japanese war cemetery. It's the only Japanese war cemetery outside Japan. And it's a pretty remarkable place to visit, again, in the middle of the Australian bush, an unexpected place to find so many Japanese buried. So that's a big shout out to the people of Cowra. They do a great job of remembering everything that went on there.
So what's next, Matt? It's a treadmill, isn't it? Writing books. You'll be on your next one, I expect. What's next?
Yeah, well, I actually did a. I've just signed a three book deal with my publisher. So, which is exciting. So, Cowra is the first one, and then I'm working on a book that you guys I know will be very interested in on the Second Battle of Krithia at Gallipoli. And you guys, I was listening to your podcast about it just the other day, which is you guys know that's a fantastic story. I've got this theme of writing about these great tragedies that should never have occurred. But I think the Second Battle of Krithia fits pretty strongly in there. And we as Australians, you might not notice this, but we tend to focus very much on what Australia did during the wars.
Oh, I'm not
perhaps
having
at
that.
The expense of other people. But the one thing we didn't realise is that we sent a brigade of troops, and the New Zealanders sent a brigade of troops down to Helles during the Gallipoli campaign to participate in one of the big attacks, one of the big British and French attacks down at Helles, the Second Battle of Krithia. So I'm writing the story of the whole battle, but obviously from a particular Australian and New Zealand perspective. And then a third book, yet to be decided, third book. So if anyone's got the ideas, let me know.
Be lazy. Third Battle of Krithia.
That the Australians didn't participate in.
No.
Great idea. So I'll write about the battles of Krithia from an Australian perspective, and then from an Australian perspective, a battle that didn't involve Australians. That'll be
absolutely.
That'll go over well.
I remember a great day out when we went to Australia, objectives of Gallipoli that we never reached. So we went to Maltepe, do you remember?
Oh, that's right,
And then up Kilid-Bahir. And the day was battlefields that weren't. It was a great day
exactly.
out.
Yeah, it was a good fun day. We visited a lot of sites where fighting didn't occur at Gallipoli.
Didn't happen, yes.
Which was pretty amazing. There was no point looking for relics up there. But
no, absolutely not. Well, thank
what do you
very
much. The big bastard, Kilid-Bahir.
The big bastard, Kilid-Bahir. That's it. Never got anywhere near it. Thank you very much, Matt, for joining us on Chatter Natter. And I would just, a lot of our listeners perhaps aren't familiar with the Cowra breakup. People like Gary who are, you know, led sheltered lives. But this is a fantastic story. And you know, if you want to read something just a bit different about the Second World War, then The Cowra Breakout by Matt McClellan is your go-to choice. As Matt said, it's easy to buy in Australia, and if you look around a bit, you'll find it in England. Thank you very much, Matt.
E-book too, I should throw out. E-books available
across
the world, of course.
Well, you're very young and modern. I was thinking when you were talking about that film series when you were about 5 and 10 or something, and I must have been in my early 50s then.
Well, I think he misheard me, Pete, because I said it was 1984 and he said he was 10. I think he thought I said 1964.
Yeah, that's right. No. Yeah, 1984, I was, 35, yeah.
Oh, dear.
All right. Thank you, gents. It's been good fun.
Cheers, Matt.
Thanks, Matt.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?